This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. The Boston Police Department plans to upgrade its crime-fighting capabilities with some modern technology. At issue, a plan to equip police cars with GPS tracking devices. Police officials say the new equipment would give supervisors a clearer picture of where their patrol cars are and allow them to speed up response times to emergencies.
But some police officers are wary of being under constant surveillance. They say the system would be overly intrusive and require them to explain their every move, maybe even compromise their ability to develop sources on the streets.
Many police departments across the country already use GPS technology on their cop cars, and the Boston plan is part of a new contract that the city and the Boston Police Patrolmen's Union agreed to. Joining us now is a former Boston police officer, Tom Nolan. He's now chair of the Department of Criminal Justice at SUNY Plattsburgh in New York. And Tom, thanks for coming back to Radio Boston. Good to have you.
Good. Thank you. My pleasure.
So first, from the Boston Police Department's perspective, give us an idea of how equipping police cars with GPS systems might improve policing.
Well, it might improve police response time in certain situations where dispatchers are able to pinpoint the exact location of a given officer's cruiser. So, for example, if a report of a hold-up alarm in a bank came in and the dispatcher was able to determine that there was a cruiser that was a block away, the dispatcher would obviously assign that unit to the hold-up alarm call before an officer who was a considerable distance away from it.
Mm. As we mentioned, a lot of police departments are using this. Do we know how it's working, if it does actually speed up response times, if it is an effective approach?
I think in certain circumstances it will be an effective approach, but officers generally, if they are in the vicinity of a hot call or priority one call, they're going to jump on that call anyway, just by virtue of how they're enculturated to respond to high priority calls. So they're not going to sit back and say, okay, a car has received the call and I'm not going to respond to it. If they're close by to the bank holdup, for example, most officers are going to jump on that call anyway.
Hmm. Now, as we mentioned in the introduction, there have been concerns expressed by some police officers who say that such a system would be overly intrusive, would require them to explain their every move, maybe even compromise their ability to develop sources on the street. Are those fair concerns from your perspective as a former police officer?
I don't think, certainly the last concern that they won't be able to develop effective sources on the street, I just don't know where that's a credible objection to this policy. I know in my last 10, 12 years as a lieutenant, I would have seen this as an extremely effective management tool to ensure, for example, that officers weren't maintaining a stationary position for a considerable period of time. And it's also something that can ensure officers' safety. If, for example, I as a supervisor or the dispatcher can't locate where an officer is or can't raise that officer on the radio, we'll now know where he or she is to be able to get to that officer if he or she is in need of assistance, for example.
I see. I would think that if there were some concern on the part of police officers, it might be concern that this plan would be used in some way to enhance supervision of police officers. For example, ensuring that an officer doesn't stray too far from his assigned patrol area. I mean, might that be a concern or not?
I don't see, it's certainly going to be a concern because officers have historically, at least in Boston that I'm familiar with, enjoyed a wide degree of latitude as to where they could travel and how long they could remain there. And I think this is going to severely restrict that now sergeants, lieutenants, supervisors, and managers are going to be able to determine if an officer is in fact on his or her area of assigned patrol or in another part of the city, for example. And I think that's a good management tool to have. And I can't see where, other than a culture change for officers who have historically enjoyed this latitude to roam, so to speak, that's going to be curtailed now. And I think it's a good tool for managers to have.
All right. Let me ask you finally about this. What about concerns about how this data is stored, how it's archived, whether it's available as part of the public record? Any concerns there that would be raised as far as you're concerned?
Well, I think that decisions around this will necessarily be made by courts and courts of appeals. So it depends on what the department's legal position is. For example, will these be considered personnel records? And necessarily kept out of the public eye through federal law, or are they public records? So I think that that's something that how the decisions around that will evolve will be that plaintiff's attorney, in the course of perhaps filing a lawsuit, Boston police lawsuit, will attempt to subpoena records like these records, these location records, GPS records, and an objection will be made by the department and the city, and then these issues will wind their way through the courts, and the courts will decide whether or not and to what extent there are privacy concerns implicated here.
All right. That's Tom Nolan. He's a former Boston police officer. He's now chair of the Department of Criminal Justice at SUNY Plattsburgh in New York. Tom, thanks so much for talking
to
us.
Thank you for having me.
It ought to be possible, in short, for every American to enjoy the privileges of being American without regard to his race or his color.
Today, in our series highlighting the speeches and moments that defined John F. Kennedy's presidency, we go back to June 11th, 1963, hours after Governor George Wallace tried to block two African-American students from enrolling in the University of Alabama. President Kennedy went on national television to announce civil rights legislation. WBUR's Kelly Horan takes us back to the president's landmark civil rights address.
Police turned dogs on African-American teenagers. Firemen turn hoses on African-American children. Birmingham is a watershed in America's civil rights struggle. It's also a tipping point for a president who has been reluctant to force a civil rights agenda until now.
Good evening, my fellow citizens. This afternoon, following a series of threats and defiant statements, the presence of Alabama National Guardsmen was required on the University of Alabama to carry out the final and unequivocal order of the United States District Court of the Northern District of Alabama. That order called for the admission of two clearly qualified young Alabama residents who happened to have been born Negro.
Kennedy makes an appeal to the collective American conscience. This nation was founded on the principle that all men are created equal, he says, and that the rights of every man are diminished when the rights of one man are threatened.
Today we are committed to a worldwide struggle to promote and protect the rights of all who wish to be free. And when Americans are sent to Vietnam or West Berlin, we do not ask for whites only. It ought to be possible, therefore, for American students of any color to attend any public institution they select without having to be backed up by troops.
In a televised interview one day earlier, Martin Luther King Jr. urges Kennedy to frame integration as a moral issue. The president gets the message.
We are confronted primarily with a moral issue. It is as old as the scriptures and is as clear as the American Constitution. The heart of the question is whether all Americans are to be afforded equal rights and equal opportunities, whether we are going to treat our fellow Americans as we want to be treated. If an American, because his skin is dark, cannot eat lunch in a restaurant open to the public, if he cannot send his children to the best public school available, if he cannot vote for the public officials who represent him, if, in short, he cannot enjoy the full and free life which all of us want, then who among us would be content to have the color of his skin changed and stand in his place?
100 years of delay have passed since President Lincoln freed the slaves, Kennedy says. Yet their heirs, their grandsons, are not fully free. Neither will America be, he says, until all its citizens are free.
We preach freedom around the world, and we mean it. And we cherish our freedom here at home. But are we to say to the world, and much more importantly, to each other, that this is a land of the free, except for the Negroes, that we have no second-class citizens except Negroes, that we have no class or caste system, no ghettos, no master race, except with respect to Negroes. Now the time has come for this nation to fulfill its promise. The events in Birmingham and elsewhere have so increased the cries for equality that no city or state our legislative body can prudently choose to ignore them. The fires of frustration and discord are burning in every city.
The president's views on the race question evolved over the course of his time in office. This ad-libbed conclusion reveals how far he has come.
This is one country. It has become one country because all of us and all the people who came here had an equal chance to develop their talents. We cannot say to 10% of the population that you can't have that right. Your children can't have the chance to develop whatever talents they have. That the only way that they are going to get their rights is to go in the street and demonstrate. I think we owe them and we owe ourselves a better country than that.
After delivering this speech, Kennedy tells a friend, "Sometimes you look at what you've done, and the only thing you ask yourself is, what took you so long to do it?" Kennedy would send his civil rights bill to the Congress the following week.
Excerpts from President Kennedy's landmark address on civil rights. Our series, November 1963, looks at some of the most important moments from the president's time in office. It's produced by WBUR's Kelly Horan with help from George Hicks. Tomorrow, Poetry and Power, President Kennedy's remarks at the groundbreaking of the Robert Frost Library at Amherst College. For an interactive timeline of Kennedy's speeches and rare archival photos and sound recordings, go to our website, radioboston.org.
And stay with us. Still to come, a sex therapist concerned about the overabundance of internet porn and the effect it's having on young people. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.